Case number 22-5047. Roger Severino, appellant, versus Joseph R. Biden Jr. in his official capacity as President of the United States et al. Mr. Mills for the appellant, Mr. Jed for the appellate.
Thank you, and may it please the court. Congress created an independent administrative conference and gave its council members terms to protect its role as a neutral advisor to Congress and all branches of government. In doing so, Congress acted in accord with the long American understanding of such terms as precluding at-will removal during the term. That's the point of the council's terms. The government's reading that a term of office does nothing to protect the office holder from removal, deprives the terms of all effect, would eviscerate the intellectual independence that OLC said is inconsistent with presidential removal power, and is the same reading rejected just a few years before the statute's enactment by the Supreme Court in Wiener. If this court were to adopt the government's reading, it would end the independence of this office and many offices protected by equivalent term provisions that have always been understood to prevent at-will removal, including by the Supreme Court and Free Enterprise Fund, SEC, Mr. Chair of the Federal Reserve.
Mr. Mills, let's start with what labels apply to Mr. Severino and the ACUS. First, was he an executive officer?
The administrative conference is within the executive branch. It's an independent agency within the executive branch.
And so the executive branch, as I understand it, has principal officers, inferior officers, and employees. What was he?
Your Honor, I don't know that the characterization under the Appointments Clause really matters here. I think it's likely that he would just be considered an employee under Lucia. I don't think he had significant authority to be sure that.
And then I know you don't think he was removable at will. Do you think he was removable for cause?
Your Honor, we don't have a position on that.
It's hard to kind of stick with that. I mean, it's hard for me to go with you. You want us to interpret the statute, and then we interpret the statute one way. You want us to decide its constitutionality. But you don't have a theory for how to interpret the statute if you don't have an answer to, was he removable for cause?
Well, Your Honor, our complaint alleges, which must be assumed true here, that he was removed for no reason. And so all we have to show is statute imposes some removal restriction.
Assume I will be unable to understand the meaning of this statute unless I can answer for myself the question, was Severino removable for cause? Then what would you answer?
Your Honor, again, I don't think we need to take a position one way or the other on that. I think Judge Silberman and Swan said it is likely that a appointee with a term appointment has protection equivalent to that of someone protected by a for-cause provision. So, and we said.
Okay, you don't take a firm position on whether Judge Silberman was right. You have not identified any case in which a term of office provision alone sufficed to limit presidential removal. Is that statement correct?
I don't think that's entirely correct, Your Honor. I think both Wiener and Humphrey's executor qualify.
Assume I've read those as closely as I can, and I don't think that it was the term of office provision alone that sufficed to limit presidential removal there. Do you have another case?
Sure. I'll just go through a couple, and I acknowledge that I'm not going to be able to give you an exact quote that you're looking for. But Swan at 987 says, it is beyond dispute that Congress generally may place restrictions such as term limits on the president's removal.
They specifically reserved the question, did not answer the question of whether he could be removed during the term, and it was just a question of afterwards.
That's true, Your Honor, but they did not say the opposite. Which
one more case, and then I got another question.
Sure. So Free Enterprise Fund. There, the Supreme Court premised its constitutional holding that dual layer removal restrictions are invalid on the fact that SEC commissioners are not removable at will.
Wouldn't the remedy in Free Enterprise Fund have been to not only refuse to apply the removal provision, but also to refuse to apply, not saying invalidate, you know, refuse to apply the term provision in order to completely, remedy is again the wrong word, but in order for that statute to be able to be applied in a constitutional way?
Well, Your Honor, that question of remedy was just not before the court. I think what the government's missing is that the entire premise of the Free Enterprise Fund decision.
What do you mean it wasn't before the court, wasn't briefed?
All parties, including the United States, understood the term provision, which is just like the one here, to prohibit at-will removal.
Your thought is that the court and Free Enterprise Fund saw a constitutional problem, and rather than rendering the regime constitutional, they left it unconstitutional?
That's right. That's exactly what I'm saying. I'm saying that if the government was right, they should have just said Parsons 130 years ago decided this. The SEC members can be removed at will.
Let me ask one more question, because I apologize to my colleagues for going on at length here, but I'm going to read some quotes from recent cases, a lot more recent than the cases that I think somewhat dominate your brief. And they speak sometimes in dicta, speak specifically to the question of whether we read a statute that has a term provision to silently limit the president's removal power. Collins says we generally presume that the president holds the power to remove at will executive officers, and that a statute must contain plain language to take that away. CELA said the removal provisions were severable from the other provisions, including the term of service provision. Collins did the same thing, as we were just discussing. Justice Kavanaugh dissenting en banc in a case that the Supreme Court then went the other way on, said, quote, term of office provisions do not prevent the president from removing at will a director at any time during the director's tenure. So assume none of that is binding, none of that is holding, it's all dicta. Is there a way for you to win this case and for those judges? I think we covered Justice Alito and Chief Justice Roberts twice and Justice Kavanaugh. Is there a way for you to win without them being wrong?
Yes, Your Honor, this statutory question was not before the court in those cases. All of those cases involve constitutional issues not presented here. Judge Kavanaugh's dissent, for example, specifically reserves this question and mentions Parsons, but this court in Swan, both the majority and Judge Silberman explain Swan as relevant to core executive officials. That's just not the case here. So that's why those cases are different than this one. And again, if you go back to Free Enterprise Fund, the Supreme Court issued a constitutional holding premise on our understanding being correct. And so this court, other than Swan, has made the same assumption, FEC versus NRA in 1993, assumed that FEC commissioners protected by equivalent term provision are not removable at will. This court in Caloris, quoting Reagan, which was just a couple years after Parson, where the term of office is for a fixed period, the appointing power cannot remove at pleasure. And your Honor's question sort of suggests a plain statement rule, but Wiener...
Even if we were to accept that those statements were binding or an accurate description of the law, wouldn't it still depend on whether they were employees versus officers? I mean, why would we presume that any such tenure of protection would apply to mere employees?
Your Honor, because I think I don't think there's any case suggesting that employees can't be protected by term provisions, and so.
Can you direct me to a statute where that is the case?
I think the Civil Rights Commission at issue in Wilson this court's decision in Wilson is similar to this agency. It primarily gave advice. The court held that staggered terms ran with the calendar and emphasized the independent advice-giving function of the agency. So I think it's plausible, at least, that those commissioners would also be considered employees, and they were also protected by fixed staggered terms, just like the council members here.
On what basis do you say he was an employee? He had one of the private citizen slots on the council. He had not paid. On what basis are you asserting that he's an employee for these purposes?
Well, the two questions about inferior officer under the appointments clause, which again, we don't think is particularly relevant here, but the individual has to have a continuing office, which we say he does because he has a fixed term, and he has to exercise significant authority. That's the test the Supreme Court gave in Luke.
Yeah, and a single individual on a council that does purely advisory functions within the executive branch, what significant authority does a single private citizen on this council exercise?
I don't think he does, Your Honor. That's why I think he's an employee.
An employee of the government?
No, I mean,
there are statutes that define what it means to be an employee of the United States government. And so what definition of employee of the United States government does private citizen on this council meet? There may be a statutory answer I'm not aware of. I'm not aware because there are employees who are on this council.
Well, Your Honor, all I mean to say is he's not an inferior officer.
He's not a principal officer. He's not an inferior officer. No, but you're being asked, you said he's an employee of the government. I'm talking about the ability. The question here is, there's imposed limitations on the removal of private citizens on a purely advisory entity.
Well, he has an appointment by the president. It's in the record. It's signed. You know, I think it's beyond dispute that he has a government position. There's a form 50 or whatever.
Well, he has some kind of position, but that's you labeled it employee, and I was just probing that. So you're not sure what his status is.
All I'm saying is I don't think he'd be an inferior officer, but I really don't think it matters what you label him under the appointments clause for him to be protected by the fixed term.
So there's a thing called the President's Council on Physical Fitness, I think, and private citizens, usually athletes or retired athletes, celebrities get appointed to that council. And I believe those appointments are for a particular term, but let's assume that there's a statute that says that they are appointed for a particular term of years. Do you think that those private citizens have tenure protection?
Your Honor, I think you'd have to look at the statute both in context and in terms of the history at the time the statute was enacted. I think that if it's structured similar to here, where the advice, all the council can do, all the conference can do here is give advice. And so that's why the chairman, JA69, said the only reason we have our recommendations have respect is because they're thought to carry expertise and political neutrality. And so if you take that away from the agency, there's nothing left. They can't make agencies adopt their recommendations. They can't make Congress adopt their recommendations. All they have is their expertise and neutrality. And if that goes away, then there's nothing else. So it makes sense that Congress would have said—
Well, there are employees of the federal government who are on this council, and the president can remove them, right, from their jobs, and then that removes them from the council.
That's true, Your Honor. And I think that only supports our point because the statute specifically limits the number of government employees. And Mr. Severino was appointed first as a government member, but later when his service ended as a non-governmental member. So I think that only supports the inference that Congress was trying to make there be some independence between the agency and the executive branch.
That seems a little odd. What independence is there between this entity and the executive branch when half of the council is members of the executive branch? And the sole function of this entity is to advise the executive branch on the conduct of executive functions. That doesn't feel separate to me at all.
Your Honor, I don't think the sole function is to solely advise.
Okay, the primary function.
Well, by statute, actually, Your Honor, it's supposed to advise all branches of government. In the statute,
it's No, it has to give a report to Congress, and it may optionally do provide information other than that report to Congress and the judiciary. That's optional. Its mandate, other than that report to Congress, is to advise the executive branch on the conduct of administrative functions, thus the name.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. I don't think...
You think its main function is to advise Congress?
I think its main function is to advise all branches of government with independence and neutrality. JA 46 note 3, OLC emphasizes...
No, tell me in the statute. Tell me in the statute where it says that. I don't want the OLC. I want it up in the statute.
I believe section 594 is where it says who the agency provides recommendations to. And I'd emphasize that it provides recommendations at its own option, not at the request of the executive branch.
Mm-hmm.
That's the point OLC makes at JA 46 note 3.
Study the efficiency, adequacy, and fairness of the administrative procedures used by administrative agencies in carrying out administrative programs. That's number one. That sounds pretty executive to me. Make recommendations to administrative agencies, collectively or individually. Sounds pretty administrative. And to the president, still administrative. You can make recommendations to Congress or the courts, but don't have to. Arrange for interchange among administrative agencies. Collect information statistics from administrative agencies. Enter into arrangements with any administrative agency. Provide assistance in response to requests for improvement of administrative procedure. That's not independent. Well, it's working with them to help improve things. And
well, Your Honor.
Presumably a good calling, but that is not remotely independent in the way as Humphreys or Weiner was.
Your Honor, I disagree. 594 subsection 1, what you just read, it's the exact same duty to give recommendations to Congress and the judiciary.
If you read the whole darn thing, if you want to tell me that your view is that this is equally advising Congress, because I read you all the provisions, right? All of that section. I mean, I can read more of it if you want, but it's all about assisting administrative agencies. But if your position depends on us concluding that this entity is equally advising Congress and the judiciary, I will accept that as your position.
Your Honor, I'm not going to say equally, but...
No, primarily, what is the function of this entity?
It's to improve regulatory processes. Okay. Sometimes that's by providing...
Sometimes? Do you have a sense of how often that they are... How often does this entity spend its time advising agencies or the president? What percentage of its time?
I'm not aware of that. All I know is that the statute gives it authority to advise all branches of government. The fact that it's advising agencies, many of which are independent... like the FCC and the FDIC, doesn't change the fact that it's supposed to give independent advice. That's what the legislative history shows, that its advice must be independent because otherwise its recommendations are not respected.
I have another question too, and that is, I really don't understand what this conference is. The conference labels itself an independent agency. You talk about that, but then in your brief, you also describe it as a federal advisory committee. I don't know that it at all fits our case law on what it means to be an authority of the United States within the 5 U.S.C. 551 definition of an agency. On the other hand, you've got a head that's appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate. That doesn't make you an agency necessarily, but it's pretty common for that. Gets the pay, same pay as an independent agency. But the assembly itself is listed as a federal advisory committee act, a federal advisory committee. And so I just don't understand what the council is. Is it an agency or is it as you said in your brief, an advisory committee? Or something else? Maybe there's another option I'm not aware of.
The council in particular?
Yeah.
The record reflects that it acts like a board of directors over the agency. I think the government concedes that the conference as a whole is an independent agency that wants the authority.
Well, you said it's an advisory committee, subject to the Advisory Committee Act on page 5 of your brief.
That's right. And it
are
is.
You aware of any advisory committee that is also a 5 USC 551 agency?
I'm not sure, Your Honor.
I don't think there are, but I'm aware of. Maybe the government will know otherwise. So, and it's, we've said that to be an agency, you have to exercise regulatory power. This doesn't have regulatory power. Hand out funds for projects. I don't think they can fund projects. Issue regulations for procedures. I don't think it can do that. I can make recommendations, but it can't issue regulations. And it can't direct executive branch officials. So I'm just trying to figure out why we think it's an why you think it's an agency.
That's how the government has characterized it.
Okay.
I agree with all those characterizations.
So maybe it's not an agency. A Title V definition of agency. Maybe there's some common law definition or something, but
there might be, Your Honor. I think those functions all emphasize the fact that it doesn't have those functions emphasize why Congress would have thought it needed to be independent.
And then to go to my colleagues, I actually had where I should have started a standing question under Swan. So the theory in Swan is that there's someone below the president who can simply treat, in this instance, treat your client as a member of the council and sort of push off the person who took his place in this instance. So in this case, the council is limited to 10 members. It has 10 members already. And given that he was a private citizen position, I don't know, are you able to identify which council member would have to be set aside so that he could be treated as a council member?
Unfortunately, I'm not. The government might be able to be.
Well, you have to establish standing. So, is your theory instead that we'll have an 11-member council? That's your relief? No, because the statute is limited to 10.
That's right.
So somebody has to go if he comes in.
That's right.
Who goes?
At the motion to dismiss stage, I don't think we need to prove exactly which person.
You don't have to establish standing?
We have to establish standing with the requisite proof required at the motion to dismiss stage. And the government concedes in footnote 1 of the red brief that we named as defendants officials who can treat the plaintiff as a member of the council.
Now, you didn't address this issue, though, about the numbering, which I don't know was an issue in Swan, didn't seem to come up there. But here, it seems to me you've got we're limited by the 10-member cap, and then that this is, like Swan again, a unusual position within a group body where it's sort of hard to identify where to slot your client in. I'm just not sure what to do. So your view is, for pleading stage, there's enough, and then there'll have to be proof as to who it was that took the particular private citizen slot that your client had?
That's right, Your Honor. Someone is in my client's spot. And under Swan, it's enough to show that the government, a corollary of Swan is that person is not supposed to be in the seat. And the individual we have named as defendant, the chairman of the council, has authority to instead treat Mr. Severino as a current council member instead of that.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll give you a couple more minutes on rebuttal.
Your Honors, Adam Jed for the United States. May it please the court. I'd like to begin, if I may, with the colloquy that my friend had with Judge Walker about what issue the plaintiff has actually put before the court today and how Supreme Court precedent applies to that issue. Because I think my friend struggled with answering the question of whether they're asking for for-cause removal. And I just want to point out, they've really gone out of their way not to ask for for-cause removal. If you look at page 11 of the Joint Appendix, their complaint, it says the president has no statutory authority to remove the plaintiff. It doesn't say that there weren't necessary circumstances met. It doesn't say that certain procedures weren't followed. It just says he has no statutory authority. And throughout their opening brief, they say things like the plaintiff has a guaranteed term. His role is inviolable. Page 15 analogizes it to a senator's term. So I think the only issue that they've put before the court today is whether someone with a term of years appointment is categorically unremovable except for by impeachment. And Judge Walker, just to kind of get into, I think, some of the doctrinal questions that you were asking my friend, I'm not aware of any federal case said that that would be true. But I actually think even if they were arguing for for-cause removal, it would still have the same problems under existing precedent. Because I think particularly recent Supreme Court decisions have made clear that a term alone is not enough, not even for non-removability, but even for some form of for-cause protection. And of course, because there's nothing in the statute, the court would then have to choose what that form is. And I'd like to just direct the court just to two cases, just to make sure that we're all on the same page about this. First, in Collins at page 1782 to 1783, the Supreme Court has a paragraph where they identify a number of agencies where they say the heads of those agencies are removable at will. And if you look through the list of, I think it's roughly 10 agencies that they identify, the vast majority of those have individuals who are appointed to serve a term of years. So in other words, the Supreme Court statement in Collins that those folks are removable at will would be wrong.
Do you happen to have the list? I don't have that page of Collins in front of me.
It's pages 1782 to 1783 in Collins. I think it's the bridge paragraph.
I'm just wondering like what the agencies are that were.
I don't have the list of agencies. I apologize. What I can tell you sort of agency specific then I think concerns the severability analysis at issue.
Before you get there, you thank you very much. And now, please, if you would, Mr. Jed, tell me again where this list is.
Carryover.
I believe it's the bridge paragraph.
Yeah. Carryover. Bottom of 82.
Okay. Peace Corps, Defense Nuclear Facilities Safety Board, CFTC, Farm Credit Administration, National Credit Union Administration, Railroad Retirement Board. So you think that all of those are removable at will?
The Supreme Court said they're removable at will.
What's the position of the United States?
You know, obviously, I don't want to.
This was dicta, so I think so.
I don't on the fly want to start opining on the removability provisions of various agencies. All that I'm saying is to the extent that the Supreme Court went out of its way to sort of point to a list of agencies.
And I understand that I would be cautious to just on the fly making representations on behalf of the United States government. But your argument, your theory of the statute here has implications that can't have been missed by the Department of Justice as it was preparing for this case. And I would think that your theory of this statute, where you are removable at will, even if there's a term in the statute for the length of service, I would think that that theory would likely sweep in the agencies that you've already mentioned. And also, I'm going to list six more: the SEC, the FCC, the FEC, the FDIC, the ITC, and the EEOC. Now, I could have my facts wrong on a couple of those, and maybe they have express for-cause removal protection provisions in them. But for the sake of this question, assume that they don't have an express for-cause removal protection term. They just have a length of years that the commissioners in those agencies serve. Are those commissioners removable at will?
Mr. Walker, I'm certainly not in a position to tick sort of agency by agency through the U.S. Code, but maybe I can answer your question in the following way, which is a plaintiff, if you were arguing for for-cause removal, which he is not, would nonetheless be basing that solely on the existence of a term and isn't basing it on any of the other features that may arise for some of those various statutes. And I can certainly tell you that Collins, and by the way, the severability analysis in Collins and Celia Law and PCAOB all confirm that having a term of years appointment, at least alone, certainly doesn't confer for-cause removal protection. I think my friend's only response to that in the reply brief is just to say, maybe the Supreme Court didn't realize what was going on in the case, or maybe the issue just didn't dawn on them, and actually it was a mistake. And I should say, one, it was holding of the court. The court was explicitly saying, given this problem, here's how we are going to sever the statute. But two, I think it would be very strange to suggest the court wasn't aware of it. At least two of those three decisions
I'm
Justice with, Kavanaugh.
I'm with you. And I think I was pretty hard on your opposing counsel. I was trying to be fair as well. But about what I saw as an incomplete theory of how to interpret the statute before we even get to any constitution. But now I'm suggesting that I think there's something somewhat incomplete, maybe tactically incomplete, about about the government's theory as well, because it can't be that the ACUS has one, we're going to interpret that statute in one way, in a way that means that the president can fire Severino. And we're going to interpret the SEC, the FCC, and the FEC in different ways. And I just don't understand why the government can't say, it has to have been a predictable question that it would be asked, why can the government not say that the theory they're applying to Mr. Severino's former agency applies to the SEC, FCC, and FEC in a way that would allow the president to remove those commissioners at will?
Judge Walker, I'm actually not sure if we're disagreeing about what I can say. Mr. Severino, again, if you were asking for for-cause removal, and he is literally asking for the opposite of that in his complaint and in his opening brief, would at best be saying that a term of year's appointment alone is what confers for-cause removal? Again, an argument he's not making, but if theoretically he were to make that argument. And I can tell you that a term of year's appointment alone does not confer for-cause removal.
That is,
I don't know that I can stand up here and give you a sort of universal theory that would apply to every statute in the U.S. Code. As Your Honor is obviously well aware, there have been some, you know, recent developments in Supreme Court doctrine, but developments on issues that aren't really necessary to resolve for the purposes of this case.
Well, can I ask if maybe you're able to comment a bit more, because we're talking here about removal of a private citizen from a collective organization. I'm assuming that there are no private citizens in roles in the agencies listed in the Collins case, or the ones that Judge Walker.
I'm sorry, I can't quite hear you.
Oh,
I apologize.
So, what seems different is the only issue before us is removal of a private citizen member of a council, which is not. I'm assuming that the folks protected by terms of office in the SEC and the assorted agencies that Judge Walker referenced and that the Collins case references, I mean, that's what they were talking about.
I mean, certainly the folks that Judge Walker was just referencing are government
full-blown
officers,
employees.
And actually the heads of the department for the
right.
most part from those examples.
Right. So isn't the only question for us removal power over a private citizen on an entity that has a purely advisory function?
I think that might be right, but I actually probably need to hedge in two different ways in answering that question. The first, just in terms of the formal status of these individuals, I think the OLC opinions about the emoluments clause that we cite do sort of discuss that. I mean, to the extent that they are serving on ACUS, they then do have a kind of government capacity.
They may be special government employees for ethics purposes, but they're not paid.
They're not paid. That's right. The chairman is paid. The council
right.
members are not. And
right.
I think Your Honor's right. I believe they
just
are
for ethics purposes.
They are SGEs. Obviously, okay. as Your Honor is aware, that doesn't, you know, that doesn't kind of necessarily sort of trigger FACA. You know, obviously, SGEs are a sort of somewhat sui generis setup. Your Honor is obviously right that most of what ACUS does is advisory. I think we have identified in our brief at least kind of one example where agencies actually need to follow a certain set of guidelines that are set up by ACUS.
Where is that?
I believe there's a statute that when HHS engages in certain kinds of arbitration, it needs to follow those both existing and future guidelines that were established by ACUS. It's kind of cited at the very bottom of the paragraph in our brief where we discuss ACUS's functions.
Okay.
You know, certainly the primary function that ACUS serves is advisory. There's no question.
Is that in the HHS statute or is that in the ACUS statute?
You know, I'm actually not. It's not in the original ACUS statute as we detail number of statutes that were created after ACUS is kind of assigned additional functions to ACUS. So I'm not sure if the statute I'm referring to, I believe it's in Title 25,
mm-hmm.
If it's an HHS-specific statute, or there are various statutes related to arbitration that have in turn incorporated some ACUS requirements.
Are those guidelines issued by the council or by the conference as a whole?
I suspect it's by the conference as a whole, but I'm not certain of the answer to that question.
Am I right that Severino, when he was on council, has to have been one of these four things: a principal officer, an inferior officer, a federal employee, or not in the government?
You know, I'm not aware of a case that sort of said that would cover the universe. It seems plausible that it would, but, you know, as I think, for example, some of the colloquies with Judge Wilkins brought up, there are a lot of these just kind of sui generis entities where it's a little unclear sort of what these folks are. You know, obviously, sort of for constitutional purposes or appointments clause purposes, once you get outside of officer or inferior officer, it doesn't particularly matter for the most part designations like employee.
So do you think that he's one of those four or some option five?
And, you know, I just don't want to take a position on that. You know, as I said, he's an SG. It's a kind of somewhat sui generis.
It seems important, though, to us. We're going to try to figure out whether he's removable at will or not. It seems very relevant to know what he is.
Well, you know, the plaintiff hasn't made any argument that turns on whether he's an employee, inferior officer, principal officer, or whatnot. In fact, he hasn't made, again, any argument about why there would be for-cause removal at all. So to the extent that the court is looking for a kind of minimal way to decide the case, it doesn't need to go any further than just to say he is not non.
Is it in the record, or I guess with the motion dismissed stage, not much of a record, is it in the public record, why he was fired?
Not that I'm aware of.
And your position is that we can't know for sure which of those four or five categories he is. What about the conference itself? Is it in the executive branch?
The conference is in the executive branch. Yeah, we cite a relevant regulation.
I'm wondering how often this happens. So I'm going to describe a group of people and then ask you a question about it. Appointed by the previous president to a position with a statutorily fixed term. Under a statute that's silent on whether the president can remove the appointee. You know how many of those people this president has fired at will without cause?
I don't know the answer to that question.
You know some, right? Because some of them are cited in your brief.
Well, if you're referring to this president, obviously I know about the plaintiff in this case. And there are, I believe, two parallel cases that are presenting the same issue and are currently
being held. And which ones are those?
I'm sorry?
Which ones are those?
One of them was brought by Sean Spicer, who I believe was put on the Board of Overseers.
Do you know if there's an instance of, I'm sorry, what was the other one?
I didn't mean, you know, I actually don't recall.
Okay, that's okay.
Apologies.
Do you know how many times, if at all, someone has been fired at will in the face of a for-cause removal protection?
I do not know the answer to that question.
In the past few years?
I just don't know the answer to the question. I mean, again, the plaintiffs aren't even arguing that we have a for-cause removal protection here, and I don't know sort of historically how often that has occurred.
Let me get to the second part of the Severino brief. And that is, you know, he argues that if we interpret the statute his way, the statute is constitutional. It seems to me there's two ways that you could win this case. First, on the statutory question, and second, on the constitutional question. Now, for the sake of this question, assume you lose on the statutory question. Assume we decide the statute prohibited the president from firing Severino. Do you want us to move to the second question and say this removal protection is unconstitutional? So Severino still loses?
So I think I need to push back on the premise of the question a little bit, which is, I think if you look at the way that the Supreme Court has approached the statutory issue, it is obviously colored by background constitutional considerations. Myers discussing Parsons makes clear that it was both statutory and constitutional. So I think it's a little bit hard to kind of tease the issues apart quite as cleanly as the plaintiff's trying to in this
case. I appreciate that. And I do think this case raises some hard questions about when constitutional avoidance has so informed the interpretation of similar statutes in the past, how much of that avoidance do we just import, kind of copy and paste style into this, or how much do we have to do ourselves kind of fresh? But that's not my question. My question's a hypothetical. I don't want to sound like... We heard a lot of this yesterday's Supreme Court argument, but it's just a hypothetical. I know you might not like the hypothetical, but in this hypothetical where we say the statute prohibits the president from firing Severino at will, do you want to win by us then saying that statute is unconstitutional?
Judge Walker, I think if the court were to do that at that point, then I might want to remand so that we can figure out kind of how that parses out. You know,
A remand for what? What would the benefit of the remand?
Well, I understand the district court to have said that this is governed by Supreme Court precedent and that we win on the statute. If this court were to say it's not governed by Supreme Court precedent and you lose on the statute.
And sometimes we remand on questions the district court has not addressed, but quite frequently for a question of law, we don't.
Sometimes they do. Judge Walker, the reason that I'm kind of struggling to answer the hypothetical is the kind of premise that I was given before. I think when the Supreme Court has approached these statutory questions, it's not just that they're engaging in kind of constitutional avoidance, as Your Honor suggested, but rather it seems that kind of background constitutional principles have colored the way that these statutes are understood. And I think Parsons is saying that. And if you actually look at some of the historical examples that might.
I'm so with you on that. You know, you had me at hello on how profoundly the statutory interpretation questions in the past have been colored by this constitutional issue. But on occasion, Humphrey's executor, Wiener, Morrison, the courts have said the best interpretation of the statute is that the president cannot fire the person at will. And it seems like this is a pure question of law. There's no need for any fact finding at the district court. It seems like the United States would say, we think in that case the statute would be unconstitutional, or we don't.
You know, Judge Walker, obviously figuring out kind of how to approach a constitutional question where on the one hand a statute would be rendered unconstitutional, on the other hand, it sort of implicates, you know, presidential removal authorities, and particularly doing that in light of some of the very recent Supreme Court cases kind of shedding light on Humphrey's executor and Myers, it's just not something that I would want to take a position on my feet right now.
Is that a reason for supplemental briefing?
If the court were interested in supplemental briefing on that question, on the question of if the plaintiffs had made an argument for for-cause removal, which they haven't, and if the statute meant that there was some either for-cause or for that matter non-removability protection, then yes, potentially we could do supplemental briefing. And by the way, just to make sure that I am understanding Your Honor's question, because I want to make sure I haven't misunderstood, I think if the plaintiff were rendered entirely non-removable, which really is the only argument that they're making, I think that plainly would be, at least raise a constitutional question and very likely be unconstitutional. But if we're talking about the possibility that it's for-cause removal, again, an argument that they haven't made, the court wanted an answer to that, then yes, I think we would want supplemental briefing.
I have one more question, and it's a pretty friendly question. How do you think we should do constitutional avoidance? Not even necessarily we, but just courts in general. Because I can imagine one version that says, you know, you interpret a statute a certain way because you want to avoid the slim possibility that the Constitution might prohibit the alternative interpretation. Well, it has to be more than slim possibility. It has to be probability. Well, it has to be more. It has to be almost certainly unconstitutional. It has to be definitely unconstitutional. Where are you on that spectrum?
Judge Walker, obviously this court and the Supreme Court have probably varied at least a little bit. And
it's another understatement.
The strength of that principle, I don't think it's something quite as clear as, you know, like the rule of lenity where you would need grievous ambiguity or something to that effect. But I actually think in this case, even if the court were interested in applying some form of constitutional avoidance, it would actually be a lot easier here. What we're dealing with would be not just kind of a constitutional question generally, but one with respect to limiting the president's powers. There, we have a sort of separate line of Supreme Court cases that we cite, as well as this court's case in Armstrong, which basically says Congress needs to be quite clear. I don't know that the court would need to wade into kind of broader, interesting statutory interpretation questions of the concept of constitutional avoidance.
Thanks for your patience with me.
Can I just clarify that answer? And that is, do you believe there's any role? Does constitutional avoidance play any role in the disposition of the statutory construction argument presented by plaintiff in this case?
No, Judge Millett, or at least it certainly does not have to. We point out that if you agreed with a number of their statutory arguments, constitutional avoidance might start to factor in. But no, it does not. And I think the answer is.
So you don't think there's any constitutional question implicated by a holding that a term provision forbids anything? Forbids dismissal at will by a president?
Oh, I'm sorry. Maybe I misunderstood the question. If a holding which said that a term provision in and of itself if some kind of for cause removal would obviously
at least if or maybe not even that, right, depending on their theory,
would obviously raise some constitutional questions. And I think in response to that, I was sort of saying to Judge Walker, I'm not sure that I'm prepared to take a definitive position on that. But
I'm not asking for a definitive position, but do you think it's a substantial constitutional question?
I think
there
would certainly be a real constitutional.
Okay, that's right.
And I should point out, Judge Millett, by the way, I mean, to the extent that my friend's statutory argument depends on this idea that every time you see an appointment for a term of years, you actually have no idea what it means, that it's kind of varying based on whether it be constitutional avoidance or I think is the way that he's constructed really just sort of as applied unconstitutionality. And I would just direct the court to what Celia Law said in the face of a pretty similar argument about what to do with their and actual statutory for cause removal provision. They said, look, we're not going to start interpreting this thing to mean different things or be unconstitutional in some places or not others. It's got a meaning. We have to go with that meaning. And here, I mean, certainly by 1966, when this statute was passed, the well-established meaning of term of years provision was that it was a limit on the length of the term, but it was not a guarantee that the office holder continued to hold the office until he's in.
Do you know how many people are on the council today?
I'm not certain of that.
If it were less than 10, would that solve the problem of where to put Severino if he were, we rule in his favor?
I mean, we have not disputed standing in the Court of Appeals. Our understanding is the logic of Swan. It's a somewhat unusual opinion, but our understanding is the logic of Swan would apply. Obviously, if the court were interested in more on that, we could also submit supplemental briefing on that question.
If there were 10, would... This is not just your understanding of how the conference works. Like, on a court, there's a spot, and when that spot comes open, there's a person who used to have that spot, and then there's a successor to that person. Does it work that way on the council? So, say there were 10, would it be easy or hard to identify who is Severino's successor?
In all candor, I'm actually not 100% certain that as a statutory matter, that's even true on a court. That may just be kind of how folks tend to talk about it. I'm not sure exactly how that would work. I mean, again, I guess to kind of engage more directly with Judge Millett's question, if ultimately the court held that Mr. Severino needed to be treated as a member of the council, presumably there would end up being some form of equitable order. And then the question would be, kind of how is that equitable order complied with? And Judge Millett, I should point out that I think in the Swan decision, when there was some discussion of kind of how possible the remedy would be, but the court did also kind of shrug its shoulders a little bit and say, well, at least if we could get him something, then that would be partial redress. So I'm not certain that he would necessarily need an official counsel seat, but the question of kind of whose seat he gets, none of that, obviously has been briefed, and that would be something that would just happen at the remedy stage, complying with whatever sort of order were ultimately issued.
Well, just for standing purposes, I'm relying only on their website, which for whatever that's worth, it's a government website. But you tell me whether it's updated. It lists 10 members and a chair, so 11 members, actually, including the chair. And so there doesn't appear to be a vacancy unless the website is not updated. So if we assume that it's full and the statute limits it, do you think that he still has standing under a Swan theory, because we can't identify sort of whom to, because Swan not only gave authority but pushed someone else out. And I don't know how we would do that in this case. What does Swan require at the motion to dismiss stage?
Obviously the issue in Swan was just redress. Is it possible to give a person their job back? You can't issue an equitable order to the president. And this court in Swan said, well, look, the plaintiff in Swan could theoretically get some form of redress, obviously at the motion to dismiss.
No, he could be treated as a member
right there,
treated as having the position at issue there. And the person who took his seat, I forget the name of that person, would no longer have that authority. It was just that it was going to be done by someone lower than the president. It wasn't just that, we'll give you an office with a name plaque and a phone and a chair. It was that he was actually going to take this position. So are you saying in this case, I just want to understand what your standing theory is in this case. Maybe y'all don't like Swan, but you haven't challenged it here. So what is the standing theory here if there isn't, as far as anyone can tell, a way to make to put him in because it's already full and it's statutorily limited to 10 people.
And for purposes of standing, all that would have to happen would be, it would be theoretically possible at the motion to dismiss stage for some lower level person, presumably the chair, to be able to provide some benefit to the plaintiff. Now, potentially that benefit could be an office and a chair, as Your Honor suggested. I mean, that itself would still be some benefit, but I'm not—
Wait, so the motion to dismiss, we don't even have to, we have to go, maybe something could happen? That's enough for jurisdiction?
Well, it's not maybe something, it's that something can happen, and whether the something—
Are you assuring me that something can happen?
We have not contested that something could happen. If the court were concerned about whether the plaintiff could be given, if it's an office or a chair, or be given a position—
I think he wants to be on the council. I mean, I can ask him, his client, his attorney can tell me. I thought the relief he wanted was to have his position on the council, not to be, you know, the paper boy for the conference.
Well, you know, I don't necessarily want to embrace every broadest statement in Swan, but we're bound by Swan, and Swan does actually suggest that kind of any benefit would nonetheless redress an injury. But Judge Millett, I'm not trying to push back on the premise of your question. I mean, we haven't disputed— I mean, we basically say in our brief, he could be treated as a member of the council. And I understood your questions to Mr. Mills to ask kind of, well, whose seat is he getting? Like, who's getting—
Okay, so your position is he could be treated as a member of the council, even if that made him, I guess, member 12, if you count the chair.
We haven't disputed that. Obviously, you know, I don't know exactly the logistics.
But the government's position is that it could happen. He could be treated as a member of the council, even if that would make the council larger than the statute allows.
I don't know whether the consequences seem— the council ends up being larger, or he gets some benefits of being a council member, or in effect, someone who's on the council ends up getting treated as if they're not a council member. Those just aren't issues that we've confronted given the way that this was set up. If the court wanted something—
Okay, if his attorney says, well, see, he says that what he wants is to be a member of the council,
Your Honor,
not less.
Obviously, sometimes plaintiffs still have standing, even if they only get less. But if the court wanted supplemental briefing on the effect of Swan on this case, given the particular current facts about the operation of the council, because that's not an issue that has been briefed in any detail, we can submit supplemental briefing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Mills, what does your client want?
To be a member of the council. And I think since Marbury, it's been settled that if that means the person who is unlawfully substituted for him needs to go, then that's what it means.
Okay, what if we can't figure out?
I think the government can figure it out. We might.
But if they can't, my hypothetical is assume they can't because we're just sort of— it's not as though he's taking the position of an agency head. That would be easy. This is a mass of public citizens that are put on here. Say five of them are put on at once. If we can't identify one.
It sounded like some relief was still possible, and that's enough.
I know, but so some relief, so less than being a member of the council is sufficient for your client.
It would be sufficient for standing, yes, Your Honor.
No, for your client's redress, that your client wants. I don't want a theoretical view of standing. Your client decides what redress they want in asserting standing. You just answered that they wants to be a member of the council, period, full stop. And so would anything less than being a member of the council, period, full stop, provide redress to your client?
Your Honor, I think there's two different questions. One would be, what would my client ideally like to be a member of the council? The second is, what minimum is required for standing?
And that's— No, there's one question. There is one question before you, and that is, what would your client accept as redress on this complaint?
To be a member of the council.
Full stop.
That's right.
Okay, then I don't need to hear about theoretical things in other cases where something less could provide standing. That's the only redress that he seeks and the only redress that he wants on his complaint.
That is the redress the complaint seeks. Yes, Your Honor.
And that's the only thing he wants?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. Sorry, we'll give you more time since I took over your time.
The government started its presentation here misquoting our complaint. It's the JA-11. The president had no authority to remove at will. It is the government's motion to dismiss and the decision below that never draw this distinction they're drawing for the first time here between for cause and other removal restrictions. Our only position is that the president lacks authority to remove for no reason at all, which is what happened here. That's all we need to prove to win. The government never provided any explanation of what effect this term would have on their reading. The president could remove it 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, 30 years. The term here would be entirely superfluous under their reading. Last, the government says there's no other features that support reading the term in accord with our reading. I've jotted down at least 10 elements that support our reading. First is the term of office and the history of similar provisions and the grammar. If you look at Humphrey's executor, there's a fixed term, a few other sentences, and then any commissioner can be removed for certain causes. Shurtleff says that last clause isn't enough. So what's doing the work of precluding removal? It's the fixed term. It has to be the fixed term because Shurtleff said that you can remove them for certain.
I'm going to try one more time on the. Is your theory that he gets for cause removal or he gets something even more protective? And here's why I think it has to be for cause removal that you're saying, even though you don't want to say it out loud. If it's something even more protective than for cause removal, then the only way, I guess, to remove, I mean, let's say a serial killer from the council would be either something like impeachment or even worse, no way to remove a serial killer from the council. It's not your position that in whatever the worst case scenario is for someone on this council, it's not your position that they cannot be removed at all, right?
No, you're right.
Okay, and so then I guess the thing that's in between for cause removal and that wild extreme is impeachment, in which case someone on the not even the chair, council member on the administrative conference of the United States has the same tenure protections during their tenure as Article III judges. As the president for his 4 years. With so many other people who. So your position is that a list of people who it takes impeachment to remove, it'll be the president, it'll be Article III judges, and it would be the council members of the Administrative Conference of the United States.
No, Your Honor, that's not our position. We're saying you don't have to decide. It's the government that wants to force you
to make that position. What's your theory?
It is that they cannot be removed for no reason.
Okay, thank you. That means they can be removed for cause. Let's clarify.
So the other 9 elements, just to run through them very quickly, the original staggered nature of the term, the government said nothing about that, that it's a multi-member body, that Congress rejected making the agency part of the president's staff, made it an independent agency, that it makes recommendations at its own discretion and directly to other branches of government, that it makes recommendations about changing administrative processes, that it limits the number of government members on the council, that it has historical neutrality, that was considered, this is throughout the legislative history, 19 to 22, vital for its mission to succeed. Its larger conference composition emphasizing balance and expertise and the lack of core executive power. All these factors confirm that the council's independence is central to its mission of providing expert advice no matter who might be in council, who might be in power. Holding otherwise would end the independence of not just this agency, but the SEC, the Federal Reserve Chair, the FDIC, and many other agencies. This court should reverse.
Thank you very much. The case is submitted.